grants from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor. Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located near the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the efforts of Republican women to shape their party. Our guest is historian Catherine Rimpf. She's the author of Republican Women, Feminism and Conservatism from Suffrage Through the Rise of the New Right. Rimpf argues that Republican women activists, conservatives, moderates, and progressives have had an impact on American politics and American feminism. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, good anywhere in the U.S., so if you're outside the local dialing area, perhaps listening online, you can call us toll-free, 800-222. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Catherine Rimpf is an assistant professor of history at the University of Missouri. She previously taught at the University of Iowa. Her book, Republican Women, Feminism and Conservatism, From Suffrage Through the Rise of the New Right, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Rimpf, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Nice to talk with you. At the outset of this book, in your introduction, you say in 1975, Republican feminists seemed to be everywhere, but in reality, the hold that Republican feminists had on the grand old party was far more tenuous than they liked to believe. Mm-hmm. So a number of questions here, just from that, you know, that little brief introduction. The first that I'd like to ask is, what were the politics of Republican women who called themselves feminists in the 1970s?
Well, that's not a simple question to answer, because Republican women who called themselves feminists in the early to mid-1970s, what they shared in common was a commitment to what I call women's rights feminism. They supported the Equal Rights Amendment. For the most part, they supported abortion rights, although there were some exceptions there. They wanted to see more women in public office. They wanted women to have more of a role in their own party. But politically, they actually came from a lot of different places on the political spectrum. I think one might assume that these must have all been liberal Republicans to begin with, but some of them were, but some of them were not. Some of them had been supporters of the conservative Barry Goldwater in the 60s. And so one of the things that I argue is that the issue of feminism in the party is part of a larger reorientation of the Republican Party in this period.
Okay. So the Republican Party in this period is already undergoing a shift, a kind of a tectonic shift?
Absolutely.
And what's going on under the surface?
What's going on under the surface? Well, in 1964, party outsiders Gothics who had for a really long time wanted to see the Republican Party nominate a real conservative to run for the presidency and had been unsuccessful in the past. In 1964, they were successful, and they nominated Barry Goldwater, who was not supported by most of the party leadership, who were the party leadership that was more moderate. And after Goldwater was so soundly trounced in the 1964 election, some people in the party looked at that and said, you know, well, these conservatives who've argued all along that this is the kind of candidate we need to nominate have obviously been proven wrong, and so we need to reestablish the party's moderate credentials. But at the same time, that Goldwater campaign brought in a lot of new people into the party who then form a core of conservatism in the party that's going to be there as other issues in this period, such as race issues and gender issues, are further transforming the political system.
Yeah. Goldwater's defeat, only a temporary setback.
Right. And didn't look that way at the time, but that's what we can see now with a longer view.
Right. In 1966, Ronald Reagan elected
governor of
California.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so then that puts us on course. We can see in a couple of decades by where we end your story in Republican Women, it's 1980, and the party has undergone dramatic transformation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And following Goldwater's defeat, then along, almost a decade later, we have the election of Richard Nixon in 72. And this is interesting to think about, too, because we've got two themes playing out simultaneously in that campaign, the Southern strategy and Nixon's claim that the GOP should be the party of the open door.
Right. And that's another great example of where the party is just not sure what direction it wants to go. One of the big criticisms of the Goldwater campaign was that Goldwater had voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and so he won a lot of support from Southern Democrats who hadn't supported the Republican Party in the past, and there were moderates in the party saying that that strategy of reaching out to Southern Democrats was a racist strategy. And so Nixon, in his campaigns, is emphasizing that, yes, we want to be the party of the open door. At the same time, he's also pursuing what is called the Southern strategy of trying to find ways to reorient the Republican Party in order to win those Southern Democrats who are increasingly disaffected from their national party. And so, again, it's an example where the message is not entirely clear. It's not clear who's going to win that battle.
Yeah. Now, you know, with the benefit of some time here, we can see things a little bit more clearly. At the time, how did women in the Republican Party along the spectrum, how did they view Richard Nixon and this Southern strategy and this idea of the party of the open door?
Well, this is an interesting example of where the gender issues and the feminist issues lead a lot of women to rethink things. One, in the in 1972, at the Republican National Convention, the party delegates were debating changes in their rules, the rules that govern the party. And that may sound like I'm opening up a really tedious topic to think about delegates sitting around debating rule changes, and a lot of it is kind of tedious, but one of the really interesting things that they're talking about is how can we change the rules to make our party broader and make our party more diverse. And what the party first and foremost was concerned about in this area was bringing more African Americans and young people into the Republican Party, because this is the early 70s. It's following on the social movements of the late 60s, where it's clear that African Americans and young people are going to be a real force in politics. They mostly seem to be moving in the direction of the Democratic Party, so the Republican Party is wondering, what can we do to bring more blacks into the party? At the same time that they're talking about diversifying the party, the language is being introduced that has to do with bringing more women into the party. It's not the primary concern of reformers, but it's in there too. And what women in the party who then go on to be real spokespersons for the feminist point of view in the party, what they find at this convention is they're just horrified by how men in the party are dismissing the issue, dismissing the idea that it's necessary to bring more women into the party. And because they experience that very personally, it opens their eyes to the need for the party to be more diverse in other ways as well. So I think some of the women who I write about go into the 72 convention already committed to diversifying the party, and others are kind of brought on board by the hostility and resistance and in some cases ridicule that they experience as women speaking up for bringing more women and giving more women authority in the party.
Yeah. Now, Phyllis Schlafly is a woman who comes immediately to mind when we think of this period, and we think of conservative, social conservatives in the GOP. She experienced sexism. She got really involved in the Republican Party in the Goldwater campaign, but she was active in Republican politics, before that. But now, Phyllis Schlafly is an interesting person, very interesting.
Absolutely.
She'd experienced sexism. She ran for office, and she was dismissed, you know, for being a woman. But it wasn't her opposition to ERA didn't develop for a bit. What would you like to tell us about her her development as a conservative, socially conservative Republican leader?
Yeah, she is, you're absolutely right, a really fascinating person. She got involved in politics in Alton, Illinois. In the late 40s, early 50s, she was active with the Illinois Federation of Republican Women and the National Federation of Republican Women. She ran for office to be a state to be in Congress in 1950, but she lost. And she was a conservative. She described herself as being a conservative, though, who was a real party loyalist, would do whatever the party asked her to do, would go out and campaign for whatever candidates the party nominated, whether or not she thought that person was the best candidate. And then she was one of these people who was really frustrated because she saw the party time and again nominating people that she didn't think were real conservatives. So she was very excited about the Goldwater campaign. She wrote a little biography of Goldwater that was used in the campaign. At that same time, she was a national officer in the National Federation of Republican Women. And after Goldwater's defeat, there was a lot of concern about what was going to happen to the National Federation of Republican Women, because this was an organization that for years had been doing the great bulk of grassroots organizing for the party that was so important to winning elections, registering voters, campaigning, getting people to the polls. And in the past, the National Federation of Republican Women had always been neutral in primaries. It didn't endorse a particular Republican over another in primaries. It supported the Republican candidates. And so there was a real concern, especially after what happened with the Goldwater campaign, about who was going to be the head of this party auxiliary that was responsible for doing so much of the grassroots work, because Phyllis Schlafly wanted to be president of that organization. She was already a national officer. A lot of people felt like she was the obvious person. And then there was a lot of behind-the-scenes machinations to ultimately end up that she was not elected as president of the National Federation of Republican Women. She was very angry about that. She threatened to take her supporters out of the federation and form her own grassroots organization. This is in 1967, and at that point, the issues she was concerned about were more not the social issues, but more traditional issues of political concern, defense issues, the size of government, taxation, things like that. And she wanted to see women mobilized around those issues. She didn't really have a position on the Equal Rights Amendment. It was not a subject of national concern at that point. And when, in the early 70s, when the ERA was being debated in Congress, and it looked like it was going to pass Congress and then go on to the states for ratification, some of her associates said, hey, you know, you really should take a look at this. She wasn't particularly interested. Once she did look at it, she decided that she was very much opposed to the ERA and begins using this new network of her supporters of hers from the Federation to educate them about the issue and her opposition to the issue, and ends up bringing in a lot of women who hadn't been mobilized by the party in the past because of their opposition to the ERA.
Yeah, that is where her power stemmed from, her ability to mobilize
right.
those women from her dining room table, essentially.
Right.
Now let's go back in time to the 1920s in the wake of the ratification of the 19th Amendment and suffrage. To what extent, how are there similarities now between the kind of Republican women activism that's going on in the 70s with what happened after suffrage?
Yes, there are. I mean, the issues are different. And so to think about this question, I think it's helpful to think more in terms of strategy rather than the actual issues that they're involved in. But one of the when women get the right to vote in 1920, women had been involved in politics beforehand, but obviously the 19th Amendment is a huge change. And there were women who identified themselves as Republicans, who are now wondering, well, what do we do now that we have the right to vote? And some of them conclude that what they need to do is work their way into the official bodies of the party, the Republican National Committee, the state Republican councils, or they're called different things in different states, that we need to be in those places because that's how we can influence party politics, and we won't have any influence unless we can do that. There were some women who pursued that strategy, and then there were others who said, you know, look, we are interested in politics because we support particular issues or because we think women will bring a kind of purity to politics that men lack, that men are naturally corrupt. These are not my views, but these would have been the views of many of these women, that men are naturally corrupt. Women will bring a purity to politics that's really necessary. And so the last thing in the world we want to do is enter these party institutions because they're corrupt, and we might become corrupted if we do that. And so we want to find ways to identify as Republicans, but not in a way that takes something away from our political purity, you could say. And the reason why I say there are analogies between that split in the 20s and what happens in the 1970s is that in the 70s you have women like Phyllis Schlafly and her supporters who strongly identify as Republicans, but they're dissatisfied with the direction the Republican Party is going. They're very happy to criticize the party and work outside the party. Meanwhile, there are the Republican feminists who I talked about earlier, who this seems, I think, ironic to a lot of people, but who were mostly party insiders. And so their desire to convince the party to take strong feminist stands on particular issues was, to a significant degree, hampered by their party loyalty, their desire to be team players, to not say anything publicly that would hurt the party. And there's a similar kind of debate going on in the 20s. But what's the best thing for women? What strategy?
Yeah, it was really interesting to read about a woman by the name of Marion Martin that you write about in Republican Women. At the time, she was beginning to get involved in pulling together all the potential energy that all these little clubs had. She looked out over the landscape and she found that sometimes these women were working for Democrats, and some clubs had developed, as you put it, a means to protest the way the Republican Party was operating locally. So you know, here we have a lot of potential power, but it's all very diffuse.
Right. And Marion Martin's view on that was one view. It was not the only view from the perspective of the 1920s and the women that I talked about earlier who want to find a way to be Republican but not be corrupted by the party. These were the women who formed independent Republican women's clubs. So they called themselves, you know, the Republican Women's Club of wherever. So they identify with the party, but they're not part of the official organization. And so they feel like they're free to define Republicanism in whatever way they want. And to them, this was very important because they were maintaining their political independence and their political purity, and they would be less corrupt, and they could bring women's values into politics. From the perspective of someone like Marion Martin in the late 1930s, who was a party official, she was assistant chair of the Republican National Committee, and she was asked to see what she could do to tap into the enormous potential of these Republican women's clubs. She looks out at these clubs and thinks, you know, this is just a disaster. There are so many different clubs. They're all operating independently. Some of them are working for local candidates. Some of them are really just having fashion shows and not really doing anything very political. Some of them are criticizing the party, either at the local level or the national level. Some of them are even campaigning for Democratic candidates. And that is not appropriate party behavior. That was her perspective on it. But the perspective of the women in these independent clubs, to many of them, it was their very independence that made their political activism worthwhile.
Yeah. So what was she able to accomplish?
What she accomplished was she organized the National Federation of Republican Women. She went out with her assistants. She toured the country, visited these clubs, convinced enough states women's club leaders in enough states that it would be a good idea to have a national organization. And basically what she does through this organization is try to control the partisanship of these clubs, control the party line, control the activities, try to get everybody on message, try to get them all working in ways that she considered to be constructive for the party. And so this was enormously important for the party because it creates this huge pool of grassroots workers who more or less are on message. She emphasizes to club women the need to be loyal to the party, to not air grievances in public. So from the perspective of the party, it was enormously important. It was not an uncontroversial decision, though, and there certainly were women who felt that this was not something that they wanted to do. They didn't want to be so tightly controlled.
Yeah, they didn't want to become party women.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
They wanted to stay. They wanted to have, they wanted to be independent.
Wanted to be independent.
Yeah. Now, as the party, as women's role within the party then is sort of evolving in this period, and to what extent was Marion Martin successful in turning club women, that's the women who favored being out in their clubs, acting independently at the local level, to what extent then did that change the role of women in the GOP in terms of were Republican women, more Republican women, party women then?
When I use the phrase party women, what I'm referring specifically to are the women who are actually members of the official organizations, the Republican National Committee, the State Central Committee, the County Central Committees. And yes, some of the club women do go on take on roles in the party itself, but for the most part, they're staying separate. These are still separate women's clubs that are separate from other party organizations, and they still see themselves differently. And she is very successful in creating the National Federation of Republican Women that, at its peak, had about 500,000 members nationwide. It's not really until the 1950s that the Federation is taken as seriously as it would be by that point in terms of getting appreciation from the party for the work that women are doing. But she's enormously successful in that regard.
Why in the 1950s did the party begin to pay heed to its women members?
Well, I think there by that point the Federation really was well organized. It had a pretty broad reach. It's not formed until the late 1930s, and so there's a lot of growing that it has to go through in the 1940s, and then the war interrupts a lot of their organizing activities. There's a lot of there's a big split in the Republican Party in 1940 over the position of the party versus the war in Europe, and so the party itself is still pretty weak in that period. In the 50s, the party's becoming stronger. It's winning elections, and the Federation itself is becoming stronger, and so it's becoming more and more clear to party leaders that women at the grassroots are doing incredibly important work, that work that the party relies on and is dependent on. So there's a lot of lip service in the 50s that we could not do this without the women. We couldn't do it without the Federation. That does not translate into women in the Federation having a very strong voice in the party. People aren't asking the Federation their opinion on who would make a good candidate or what position the party should take on a particular issue. That's frustrating to some women. It's not frustrating to all of them.
Hmm. Does this history of the role Republican women had in shaping their party, is it mirrored in the Democratic Party?
There are some parallels in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party doesn't form a national organization in the way that the Republican Party does. But some of the same issues of, do we want to be integrated into the party as women in a kind of separate way from men, or do we want to be integrated into the party as equals? Those are also questions that are being explored in the Democratic Party. In the Democratic Party, a lot of the grassroots organizing that the Federation does for the Republicans, in the Democratic Party, a lot of that is done by labor unions. So there's a little bit different dynamic there in terms of how dependent the party is on women.
Yeah. And what about the New Deal?
The New Deal. In what way?
In terms of mobilizing women mobilizing the Democratic Party and women in the Democratic Party.
Right, right. In the New Deal, which was Franklin Roosevelt's program in the 30s, his New Deal government and the people working for the Democratic Party during the New Deal did a lot to mobilize women, not under an umbrella organization like Republicans, but it's clear in the 30s that the party was mobilizing women, that it was, and I think this is quite significant, the New Deal appointed a lot of women to positions in the administration, in the federal bureaucracy, and so there's a kind of general sense that this is a party, the Democratic Party, that does a lot for women. And that was something that the Republicans felt like they needed to counter. And that was a big motivation for asking Marion Martin to try to form a women's organization within the party, the sense that the Democrats have just done so much more than the Republicans.
Hmm. Historian Catherine Rimpf is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Republican Women, Feminism and Conservatism from Suffrage Through the Rise of the New Right. The book looks at the role, the efforts of Republican women to shape their party from 1920 to 1980. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. How did Republican women view the New Deal?
Well, this is during the 1930s, the Republican Party was obviously very much on the outs. I mean, it wasn't. It's not only that it had lost the presidency; it lost significantly in the Senate and in Congress. There isn't a very strong Republican organization, either nationally or at the local level. And so Republican women who had formed clubs in the 1920s were kind of limping along in the 30s. And a lot of those clubs from the 20s don't survive into the 30s. And I think the kinds of clubs that did survive tended to be the ones that were very opposed to the New Deal, because they could kind of they had a real mission, because they viewed the New Deal as so dangerous. They could use that fear of the New Deal as a way to mobilize women. You know, look, there's something really dangerous facing our country, and women are the only ones that can solve it. So that the women who were organized into Republican clubs tended to be very opposed to the New Deal.
Mm. At this point, also, is there a split? Is there a growing movement among African Americans away from the Republican Party?
Right, and that's something we haven't talked about yet. That in the 20s, when Republican women were forming women's clubs, it wasn't just white women doing this. African American women were actually kind of ahead of the game in forming African American Republican clubs and actually forming a national umbrella organization of these clubs. Because in the 1920s, the overwhelming majority of African Americans still identified with the Republican Party, which is something that dated back to the end of the Civil War. In the 30s, by 1936, the overwhelming majority of African American voters had switched their allegiance to the Democratic Party. There were still African American women who identified with the Republican Party, though, and so there are still a few of these Republican women's clubs that are black women's clubs that survive the general switch in party allegiance for most African Americans, and they tend to be women who were pretty well off, who were older, so that their loyalty to the Republican Party was long-standing. They were maybe married to small businessmen, and who really identified politically with the Republican Party. But they're certainly a minority among African Americans by the late 1930s.
Mm. What were the issues important to women who identified themselves as Republican, black and white, through this period, let's say from the 20s to 1950?
Well, it's going to changes a lot in that period. In the 20s, the Republican Party still contains a lot of people who identify with progressivism, which was movement of the early 20th century, supporting a host of social reforms. And women were quite active in the progressive movement, and many of the independent Republican women who formed clubs in the 1920s were of that progressive tradition. And so when they think about their Republican politics, one thing that would have been of great concern to them would be opposition to political machines, trying to make local government less corrupt. Many of them were also temperance supporters, so they supported prohibition. Those are some of the local issues that they would have been concerned about. Concern for legislation that would benefit women and children. Those would have been issues in the 1920s. For African American women in the 20s, they of course place a great deal of emphasis on civil rights, trying to draw attention to the fact that African Americans in the South do not are not able to exercise their rights under the Constitution to vote, for example, and that's a very important issue to them. By the 1930s, though, I think the Republican women are becoming more reactive. They're reacting against the New Deal, which they see as promoting big government, which would be, in their mind, would lead to corruption, opposition to New Deal spending programs, taxation, things like that. By the 1950s, one of the big issues that Republican women have taken on is anti-communism, and that becomes quite important to their organizing in the 50s.
Hmm. Also in that post-war period of the 50s, I would imagine that something else was going on, and that would be that more and more women were achieving greater levels of education.
Right, right. Although it's not, and this may seem counterintuitive, but women in these Republican clubs, for the most part, are not talking a lot about what we might think of as women's issues. They're not talking about the fact that women are achieving greater levels of education, that women are being denied certain employment opportunities. For the most part, when they think about, and they certainly see themselves as women, as having a special connection to politics as women, and that they're concerned about particular issues because they're women. And so that's how they would frame their anti-communism, for example. This is an issue of particular concern to women because women are able to recognize dangers threatening our country that men aren't able to recognize. Anti-communism for many of them was connected to religion. Communists are atheists, and it's very important to us to counter that. And so they saw that as a women's issue, although we might not today think of that as a women's issue.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So who was drawn to feminism's second wave, and why?
In the Republican Party?
Yeah.
Well, it was, as I said, they were women who came from across the political spectrum. Some of them had been Goldwater supporters in the 60s. Some of them had worked against Goldwater in the 1960s. They were mostly the party women that I've talked about, women who had been had positions in the party and who had experienced discrimination as women in the party, and who, you know, hadn't really had a movement to organize behind in the past, but when it is starting to emerge, both nationally and within the party, they're ready to go there. And there are a number of prominent women who became active in this movement. One of them is a woman named Mary Louise Smith, who was it was an interest in her that first got me interested in this subject. But she was the first woman to chair the Republican National Committee. She came in after Watergate, when the party was trying to reinvent itself after Watergate. And her background, she was from Iowa. She had been involved in her local Republican women's club in Iowa. She was elected to be the Iowa National Committee woman, to serve as a member of the Republican National Committee. She was elected in 1963. She was a real party player, a party loyalist. She went to that 1972 convention not thinking of herself as a feminist, but while there, she talked with some of the women who were doing the organizing in support of the reforms to the party, and in talking with them, she came to realize that, yes, she did identify with these issues, and she came to identify herself as a feminist very proudly and very openly. But it was a kind of a journey for her.
Yeah, and she must have seen Nixon's statement, the party of the open door, mm-hmm. as something that held a lot of promise.
Right, right, held a lot of promise. And I think she believed that for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, in the 70s, of course, we have the Equal Rights Amendment sent out to the states, and then we have the Roe decision, mm-hmm. and we have a backlash.
Mm-hmm.
And this is—it reminds me of what you said just a moment ago about Republican women being involved, so involved in raising the alert about communism. Here we have women doing something that also seems a little counterintuitive.
Raising the alert about the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah,
yeah.
And Roe.
Right, and Roe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So talk about that period and how women, you know, that's mm-hmm. also when Phyllis Schlafly arrives back on the scene.
Right, and she is incredibly significant in mobilizing women around these kinds of issues. And what, there's a lot of different ways that you can talk about the debate over the ERA in the 70s. And if we want to look at how that debate, just for our purposes today, to look specifically at how that debate plays out in the Republican Party, a big question there is about the image of the Republican Party. Is this the party that supports ERA and abortion rights, or is it the party that doesn't? And again, it's something that today it may seem very clear to us what direction the party was going to go on that. But it really, and I can't emphasize this enough, it really was not clear in the 1970s that the Democratic Party would get identified with one side of that debate and the Republican Party would get identified with the other. It really wasn't clear. And what Republican women who were feminists argued, they argued that, there's this long tradition of support for women's rights in the Republican Party. There's a long tradition of support for individual rights, and therefore it's very logical that the party would support these particular feminist issues. And so they're framing it in terms of what the party traditions are. For those women who are mobilized against the ERA, they don't have that stake in the traditions of the party, because so many of them are new to party politics. They're not trying to frame their opposition in terms of party traditions. They're opposed. And so they're framing it in terms of the reasons why they oppose the ERA, which have to do with what they see as very disruptive transformations to gender relations that would happen as a result of ratification of the ERA, and transformations that they saw as very harmful and very threatening.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Illinois was such a battleground state, and the lobbying of Betty Ford turned out to be a mistake, a tactical mistake in Illinois.
Yeah, and I don't think that was clear to supporters
at the time.
ERA at the time. ERA supporters were really blindsided by the strength of the opposition and the fact that the opposition was coming from women. That's not something that supporters expected, and then they initially dismissed it, that these are women who are just pawns of men. They don't really know what they're talking about. No one's going to take them seriously, and so we don't have to take them seriously. And they were absolutely wrong about that.
Mm-hmm. So over this period of time, from the 20s to 1980, we've seen a lot of changes. We've seen battles for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. Where do you think things stand at the moment? Socially conservative Republicans are very influential in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you would say they are as influential at the state level.
It varies from state to state,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the Republican feminists in the 1970s, what I would say is there is this moment, and you read from the introduction to my book, that there's this moment in the mid-70s where, depending on where you cast your net out, you could rein in a lot of Republican feminists. And if you looked in the right direction, you would think this is a huge movement that's going to be, this is really telling us the direction that the party is going. And there are some reasons for that. And I think a very significant reason was the fact that there was a broader feminist movement. It was a mass movement that needed to be taken seriously. And feminists in the Republican Party could say to others in the party, hey, you may not agree with this movement, but it's out there. Many, many, many women do agree with it, and if we want to be a viable party, we have to reach out to those women. And today, I would argue that does not exist. There is not a mass feminist movement that is really playing into the calculations of leaders in the Republican Party. Feminism is now pretty much understood to be associated with the Democratic Party, institutionalized feminism. The big organizations are seen as being firmly in the Democratic camp, and that is not a constituency that the Republican Party is really trying to win.
Mm. That's very interesting, though, to me. We have to wrap up here, mm-hmm. but that thinking about this, the topics that you take up in your book, it seems though that the second wave of feminism and that period of time there in the 60s and 70s, provided Republican women of all stripes with more clout.
Yeah, yeah. Because they could be seen as well, that's not exactly the way that I want to phrase it, but that the second wave feminism made certain issues matters of public debate that had not been in the past, like the ERA and like equality, and so that and there are so many other specific issues or general issues. And it may be obvious where those issues gave clout to Republican feminists because they supported those issues, but they also gave clout to those who opposed feminism, women who opposed feminism, because by making an issue like the ERA, because the ERA became such an important issue that was debated at the state level, at the national level, women who organized against it were really important political players, and that was something new.
Mm-hmm. There we have to leave it. Catherine Rempf, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
You're very welcome. Catherine Rempf is an assistant professor of history at the University of Missouri. She is the author of Republic.